Do it again.
Of all the gin joints in all the towns in all the world.
You're listening to Drinks, Jokes, and Storytelling.
Hey girl, a martini, shaken, not stirred.
Don't try and church it up, son.
You can't handle the truth.
I am big. The picture that got small.
Your first one's on us.
Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to Drinks, Jokes, and Storytelling. I'm your host, Mark Riccadonna, and with me as always...
Richie Byrne.
Your producer, Soul Joel.
And today we have a very special guest.
Very cool guest.
Very cool.
Very
this
excited.
This guy is an old friend of mine, which we've been palling around for quite a while.
Decades. Doing some crazy shit. I've seen Mark go from crazy, irresponsible, to... married with kids and irresponsible,
and crazier.
We cut out the drugs. Everything else is the same.
Yeah, true. Yeah, that's true. Wow, that's a great point. Yeah, everything else is still kind of a mess.
Folks, Craig Gass.
Craig Gass.
What?
Craig Gass is in the house.
Oh man, you might need to Google that. Craig Gass, everybody. Craig Gass.
I was in the city the first time Craig Gass came to Manhattan. And
really?
Yeah. And I can't believe you don't remember this, because it was an interesting... You called Tony Bevacqua at Dangerfields during the day and pretended to be Sam Kinison.
Holy shit.
And told him that it was all a lie, that I'm alive.
Holy shit.
Do you remember this?
Vaguely, yeah. And I do vaguely remember going... And then...
And you freaked him out. He really thought he was talking to Sam. And he invited you to come in that night and perform.
Holy shit. I was on
the show, and you were staying in Connecticut. I can't believe you don't remember this, because you were freaking out. You didn't know how to get to the train to get to Connecticut. And I drove you over. And you acted like I took you to Connecticut. I just drove you to the train. You're like, dude, so nice of you, man. Really nice of you to do that, man. You're really stand-up guy.
I'm an appreciative person. I'm a ridiculously appreciative person. But, yeah, I remember I had actually just come out to New York, and I was staying with Mitch when I first moved in. I was living with Mitch Hedberg. And I remember that was actually a couple months in. I had started to I got all my stuff up to Connecticut because I realized how crazy it was living in Manhattan. I think I showed up with... $3,000 to move to New York, and I'm like, all right, $3,000 is a good slush fund, like to get ready.
You
in New York.
Got 1 month's
That's a
rent.
Great week.
Oh man, that'll
That's
get me
like
started.
A 48-hour period.
And, yeah, and I didn't realize like the cheapest thing I could find in New York City at the time was $1,000 back then for a studio,
yeah.
And you needed first, last, and another full amount for the deposit. So $3,000 was everything just to move in. So I was screwed, but. My first spot in New York was actually at New York Comedy Club.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought it was that. I'm sorry.
Yeah, it was New York. It was I remember the day I came in. I'm a weird, like...
savant?
For dates, yeah. And I remember leaving Seattle. I started my comedy career in Seattle, and I left Seattle on April 13th, 1998 on an Amtrak train. Arrived in Penn Station on April 16th, 1998, and Mitch picked me up at Penn Station. And I'm originally from New York, but I left when I was 10 years old. I grew up in Mount Vernon outside the Bronx.
I was gonna say, what, Mount Vernon?
And so I get into town, and Mitch has spots at the Comic Strip, at Stand Up New York, and I think there was one other place. And I got myself a spot at 12:30 or 1 a.m. at the New York Comedy Club. And I walked into that place. This is a crazy stand-up story for anybody who – I always give this as advice to, like, dude, you never know. You never know. So he's doing his spots, and I walk into the New York Comedy Club with Mitch at 12:30, 1 o'clock in the morning. There's six people in the room. And even Mitch looked at me and said, you sure you want to do this? And I go, fuck it, dude. It's New York. I'm going to perform in New York City. Yeah. I even walked on stage going, what's up, New York? For six people. And then I do my 6 minutes. And the stage back then at New York Comedy Club was a box that actually moved with your body weight. If you push your body weight
like
too much.
You remember that place?
The stage would actually move. And I do my 15 minutes, whatever it was. I get off stage, and I go, all right, let's get the fuck out of here. Mitch and I jumped in the cab. We got out. A month later, I came back to that same club, New York Comedy Club. Walk in. The guy at the door is like, hey, is your name, are you Craig Gass? And I go, yeah. And he goes, I need to get your phone number. And I go, oh, sure. You want to book me? And he said, no. There was someone from VH1's trying to get in touch with you. And I said,
oh.
In touch with me? And he goes, yeah. Weren't you here like a month ago with Mitch Hedberg? And I go, yeah. And he said, and then you walked right out. And I go, yeah. He said, yeah, one of the people in the audience was a guy from VH1. He was trying to figure out how to reach
one
you.
One of the six people?
One of the six people.
Meanwhile, I thought you said Steve Aarons was booking a Bringer show and wanted to get in touch with you. That's fine.
And I'm like, you're kidding. And I go, wait. I go, do you have the guy's number? And he goes, he's looking through his, like, he had a Rolodex of business cards. And he goes, I can't. He goes, you know what? Just call information and ask for the business phone number for VH1. It's at 1515 Broadway. And then just ask for this guy. His name is blah, blah, blah. And I called and got the phone number, called VH1. Hi, I need to speak with so-and-so. They put me through. I get his voicemail. Hi, you've reached so-and-so, the head of casting and development at VH1.
Jesus.
And I said, hey, it's Craig Gass. I just got a message that you're looking for me. And the guy called me right back, and he said, Craig, I needed you a week ago. You were the perfect host for this show.
Shut up.
And I don't even remember what the show was, but it was something at VH. It was my first night in New York.
Wow.
First night in New York City.
That's what I was trying to say before, because, you know, Mark speaks very highly of you. I've listened to you a lot of podcasts. I'm a huge fan of you. I just got to meet you now. But it seems like that luck has followed you your entire life. You've been the right place at the right time. Like, at different concerts, you met Kenny G, and then at the Cubs game, you were at the World Series when the Cubs won. You went Facebook Live just to celebrate the Cubs winning the World Series and getting that monkey off their back. And who goes over your shoulder but Bill Murray?
Bill Murray showed
up. I'm like, that's crazy. It has nothing to do with your comedy connections.
Dude, I mean, it runs even deeper than that. I lived at Eddie Van Halen's house for 4 months.
Well, who hasn't? Seriously.
Been there, done that.
Jesus. Mitch was a roommate of mine. I lived at Eddie Van Halen's house for 4 months. I'm the only comedian to ever open for Metallica. I've opened for Motley Crue. I've opened for System of a Down. There's a great video of me opening for Motley Crue on YouTube. The same thing I did opening for Metallica, same thing I did opening for System of a Down, which is I walk out in front of an arena full of people and say, good evening, my name is Craig Gass, and I am Metallica's sound man. Yeah. And I say, the band has some very important announcements that you need to hear. And then I just make up a bunch of cool shit that's not going to happen. And they all listen. And they all, I have their complete attention. And at one point I'll say, you may have heard some rumors, and it's true. Metallica is recording their first ever live album right here tonight. So I need your attention. I need your attention.
Oh, no.
There's a proper way to yell on a live album. So we need to rehearse this. And then my instructions get dumber and dumber as the night goes on. But they're listening and they're laughing at every stupid fucking thing I tell them. And and then by the time, you know, my 20 or 30 minutes is up, it's like, I'm just fucking with you. I'm a comedian. Craig Gass, get ready for Metallica. And then everyone goes, I don't know what that was, but yay. Yeah. Don't even know.
How is Metallica? They were good, but the weird guy up front.
Yeah. Yeah. I just did it a week ago, opening for a really cool new band called The Struts, who the singer looks and sounds shockingly like a young Freddie Mercury. It's fucking crazy how great this band is. And I opened for them in Hollywood. They did 4 nights, sold out at the Roxy. And while I was on stage, the guys in the band were getting text messages from friends going, your sound man's fucking hilarious, man. Like, yeah. Yeah. It was
so
just,
you're still doing the sound man thing.
Oh, yeah, man. I mean, it's turned into a whole act of
good,
like,
for you. I would be like,
when I first started doing stand-up, when I'd open for a band, I'd pretend I was the tech. And I'd go out and fuck with the guitar. And then I would just start talking to him like I was like,
oh,
check,
yeah.
Check, hey.
Well, it started with Metallica. When I opened for Metallica, one of the guys in the – well, actually, all the guys were really supportive of me. But one of the guys, the drummer, was the guy who said, yeah, let's get you to do the show. And I still have the message saved in my voicemail when I called him and said, hey, if you guys had any balls, you'd let a stand-up comedian open for Metallica. And I still have this message. Boop. Hey, man, it's Lars. Got your message. And, yeah, whatever it is, man, I talked to James and Kirk and some of the other guys. Come down and do a couple, 10, 15 minutes, whatever it is you want to do, and we'll fucking do it, huh? Huh? And then and he wanted to go on stage and introduce me. He was actually promoting me on K-Rock, which I was working at on the time. I was working on at the time. I was part of the Howard Stern show. And so Lars went on and said, yeah, we got your very old Craig Gass is going to open for Metallica tonight. And I was like, don't tell people. Like, I don't want people coming to the show preparing.
Right.
Hey, did you hear a comedian's going to perform? Yeah, let's fucking kill him. Like, just even the idea that a comedian's going to perform it just is going to incense the crowd.
Right.
And Lars said, well, what do you want me to do? He goes, I got it. I'll walk out on stage and I'll say, hey, Metallica's about to come out and kick your ass in about 30 minutes. But first, I'm going to have a good friend come out and tell you some jokes. And I was like, are you fucking crazy? Don't, like, hey, here's one of the guys from Metallica. You guys ready to rock? All right.
You want that for your reel, but you don't want that while you're
like,
doing it.
Yeah. You kind of caught in the middle.
You go out on stage.
Who doesn't want Lars Ulrich to open for you?
Yeah, the lights go down, and everyone goes crazy, and you see a guy from Metallica, and he says, hey, you guys ready? All right, well, let me bring out a friend to tell you some jokes. Like, like, who the fuck's going to put up with that? And he said, what do you want me to do? And I said, just give me the mic, and I'll just walk out and start talking. Like, I don't want anyone to know, hey, we're about to watch stand-up comedy. And then it dawned on me, like, what if I told everyone I work for the band? And then I started doing that, and I walked out on stage, and I got away with fucking murder doing that. And then I started doing it for System of a Down asked me to do it with them in Toronto. There's a great review of that show for that System of a Down show where the sound man was hilarious, got everybody in a good mood, and blah, blah, blah.
The sound man.
And then,
this is so crazy because this is what I actually did as the guitar guy.
Really?
And I go out and mess with the guitar. And then after the show, people were like, the tech was hysterical. That guy should be comedy.
It's a great fucking way to get people to listen to you. But yes, a lot of. So the Cubs, Bill Murray. There's a guy who runs a very popular local restaurant in Cleveland called The Melt.
I know The Melt.
Yeah.
Great.
And it's a grilled cheese restaurant. They have 30 different types of grilled cheeses.
Yeah. They have like a pound of grilled cheese.
Yes. And I come into Cleveland and I ask, like, hey, what should I do while I'm in town? And everyone starts saying, oh, man, have you gone to The Melt? You got to do grilled cheese. You like grilled cheese? You got to go. So I said on the air, why does everybody in Cleveland want to stick their dick in a grilled cheese sandwich? Like, why is everybody obsessed with this grilled cheese sandwich place? And The Melt tweeted me and said, hey, Craig, you should come out and experience some of the magic that we have here with our grilled cheese sandwiches. And I tweeted him back and said, I got a better idea. How about you come to my show and bring some sandwiches for my audience? And they did. The owner of The Melt showed up at my show and brought 100 grilled cheese sandwiches.
Wow.
And
smart
we
move.
Wow. Threw the, very smart. You're smart absolutely move. Right. Because the only thing he said to me before we walked out on stage was, can you do me a favor? Because all I ask is that when we throw these sandwiches out, make an announcement and say, listen, if you catch a sandwich, please tweet about it. And he knew how much that was going to trend.
Wow. Yes.
People going, dude, they're throwing out grilled cheese sandwiches. The comedy show. I caught a fucking sandwich. Like, who cares about the comedy show? Fucking free grilled cheese sandwiches. And so we threw sandwiches out to the crowd, and the place went fucking nuts. And the owner of The Melt also happens to be a huge Kiss fan. He's got Kiss tattoos, and I've been making jokes about Kiss for decades.
I guess he's a fan.
So he knew who I was, and we bonded. So Game 7 of the World Series, I get tickets, and I go to Game 7. And
I forgot we were still on this Bill Murray thing.
Yeah, and I texted all my friends in Cleveland, and the one of the guys I texted was my buddy who owns The Melt, and he said, dude, I'm in the third row. I'm sitting behind Eddie Vedder and John Cusack. And I said, well, if you want to meet up, let me know. And he said, you won't be able to get to me. He said, because I'm behind a wall of cops here and security. And I was like, all right, well.
You don't know who you're talking to.
Well, and that's the crazy thing. That's the crazy thing. I have this Forrest Gump moment where I'm walking around the stadium.
Oh, God.
And this dude who works for the Indians, who I got to point out was a black dude who stopped me and said, hey, weren't you on that metal show? And I was like, you're a metal fan? And he goes, oh, I love metal. Wow. And I was like, oh my God, really?
You're the one?
You're the one? Yeah. Chris Rock always says, there's always that one black dude at a heavy metal concert. He's like, I'm that black guy. So this dude is telling me, he's like, dude, I love Metallica. I love Kiss. And I go, you love Kiss? I go, well, you know about my problems with Gene Simmons that he almost killed me. And he goes, no, man, what was it? And I start telling the story and he's laughing. And every couple of minutes, he has to stop because a fan comes up and says, excuse me, and they show him their ticket. And he goes, oh, wait, hold on one second. He checks tickets and he scans them. And he goes, oh, yeah, you're good here. And he gives out wristbands to these people. And then he keeps stopping every so often. He goes, oh, sorry, let me just scan this. Yep, you're good. Here's your wristband. And I go, what is the wristband for? And he goes, oh, it's for us. It's our home run club. It's behind home plate.
Oh, get out of here.
It's a special private club.
And this is during the World Series.
And he goes,
the guy in charge of getting you back.
And he goes, do you want one? And I go, sure.
Cut to Craig in the bathroom blowing this medal.
So the guy turned out to be a fan of mine.
He gives me a wristband. He gives me a wristband and then goes, hey, so tell me more about this Gene Simmons thing. And I go,
I got a wristband now. I don't really need to talk to you anymore.
I talked to him for another minute or two, and I go, dude, do you mind if I just go to this club? And he goes, oh, yeah, go, because it's the fifth inning at this point.
Right,
so.
Right.
You blew the guy off.
Which, by the way, none of this would have happened if you didn't suffer from ADD.
Yeah. Good point. Oh, my God. That's a great point. My ADD leads me into a bunch of, yeah. So I start, I go into the home run club, and I text my buddy again from the melt. I go, dude. I think I'm about 10 rows behind you in that private club behind you. And he goes, okay, I'll come up in a minute. He comes up and he says, hey, if there's an empty seat, I'll let you know. For game 7 of the World Series, he says, if there's an empty seat.
Oh, yeah.
And in the eighth inning, he goes, dude, there's an empty seat 4 seats over from me.
Are you kidding me?
One of the wives.
I hate this story.
One of the wives from the Cubs.
Yeah.
It brought her baby without any ear protection. So she leaves to help because the place is going nuts and she's trying to cover her kid's ears. So she leaves and he goes, come on down. And I without a ticket, I glance down and I start walking a few rows up and he stands up and he goes, yeah. And he goes, hey, everybody get up, make room for this guy. And everybody gets up and there's an empty seat. I sit down. The guy in front of me turns around. It's John Cusack. And I go, hey, how you doing? And then in front of him is Eddie Vedder. So I'm third row center behind home plate. And then as we get into the bottom of the 11th, the Cubs are about to win the World Series for the first time in 100 years. I've never gone to a World Series game. I've been telling people for years, I'm only going to go to the World Series if the Chicago Cubs make it to the World Series, to which everybody says, then you're never going to the World Series. And I am now about to watch the Cubs win the World Series. I take out my phone and I start doing a Facebook Live. It used to count down, 3, 2, 1, you're live. It starts counting down, 3, 2, 1, and I feel somebody leaning on me. I turn around. It's Bill Murray, and he's drunk and crying. And and we're literally one strike away from winning the world. The Cubs are one strike away from winning the World Series. And I'm looking at, and I'm about to get the greatest shot ever. I got Eddie Vedder and John Cusack in the shot with the Cubs about to win. And Theo Epstein's in front of me. All the management. Billy Corgan from Smashing Pumpkins is behind me. And I got this great shot. And Bill Murray is starting to interrupt the shot. And
Bill Murray's kind
of. And there's so many things I want to say. I want to look at Bill and go, I love you. I adore you. I have loved you since I was but all I can say is, Bill, hold on. Hold on. And I get the shot, and then there's a hit down the third baseline. They throw it across. The Cubs win the World Series for the first time in 100 years. I turn around. Yeah! And I start high-fiving Bill, and we're hugging. All the national TV shots of Bill Murray, the biggest Cubs fan in the world, are of him hugging and high-fiving a guy with a Mariners hat on. And who's the guy that he went to the game with? I did not go to the game with Bill. He snuck up.
Oh, they were saying that?
And everybody, I was getting, my phone was exploding with people going, get the fuck off my TV, you asshole! Which is the same thing that happened at the Super Bowl when the Seahawks won the Super Bowl. I was on the field with the Seahawks because the Seahawks are so great to me that they give me a job whenever I go to a game. And they gave me a job at Super Bowl 48. I was the team photographer's assistant. And
what?
So I got to hold cameras.
During the digital age when you don't need an assistant.
Yeah. Oh, there's a lot of.
Did you go out to the crowd and go, I'm the team photographer's assistant. We have some rules.
We have some important announcements.
Listen to me. The Seahawks want you.
I get the Lombardi Trophy first, according to the rules.
Check my credentials.
I need your attention. Yeah, so I found myself in a lot of crazy Forrest Gump moments. But that moment, that Facebook Live, if you watch it, I'm literally 1 foot away from Bill's face. I mean, his face takes up the entire screen. He's crying and laughing. We're hugging each other. We're high-fiving each other. And then he climbs over my seats, to get to the front. And then I pan around, and then I have Bill and Eddie Vedder and John Cusack all hugging with Bonnie Hunt. And it was crazy. And those weren't my seats. That was now, the craziest part about the story.
Are you a Cubs fan? Or you?
I've always loved underdogs. So, yeah, okay. The Cubs have always been the ultimate underdog. I was a Yankees fan as a kid.
The Indians weren't that far behind them.
Yeah, I know. If the Indians would have won, it still would have been a great story.
Yeah, I mean,
but it doesn't compare to the Cubs. Right. And also keep in mind, when you talk about Cleveland being in a funk, that the Cavaliers had just won.
That's right, LeBron.
4 months earlier,
right.
With a homegrown talent of LeBron James.
Right.
I'll always remember seeing Dave Chappelle make a joke about there's not many. What was it? He goes, there's not much fame that compares to LeBron James in Ohio fame. And he said, to give you an idea of how famous LeBron James is in Cleveland, LeBron James, God forbid, could shoot Donald Trump in front of a pack of poor white people. And those white people, if it's in Cleveland, will go, LeBron. If it's a game day, they'll go, LeBron, we got to get you out of here. That's how famous LeBron James is that he could, God forbid, shoot Donald Trump in front of a group of poor white people. Yeah, it was. But so with that in mind, Cleveland had felt the taste of, you know, a victory. But Cubs fans, that's multiple generations of people.
It's ridiculous.
Going through an entire life into their having, you could have grandchildren, great grandchildren, and be a Cubs fan and never experience that.
Right.
And multiple generations experience that without having a championship. So I knew it was more special for the Cubs to do it. So.
And you were in Chicago.
And in Cleveland.
No,
the game,
oh, no, oh,
game
no,
seven.
The grilled cheese, right?
Game seven was in Cleveland.
Right.
Yeah,
it was confusing because all the Cubs people were behind home plate.
Yeah. They were all, you know, the ownership and all that stuff. Yeah, they were all, and there was a lot of, I felt like it was pretty split that night for game seven. I did meet a lot of people who drove out that day that, like, a buddy called, listen, man, this is something we waited for our whole lives. Let's drive to Cleveland. You know, and
Chicago and Cleveland's not that far.
Yeah, it's not that
right,
far.
There right, were right. a lot of stories about that, about people driving out and everything.
Yeah, and I'm a huge underdog fan. I was a Yankees fan. That was my birthright because I'm from Mount Vernon. I grew up 10 miles from Yankee Stadium.
Right.
And but something, I was like in the 70s, I had Reggie Jackson, Bucky Dent, Willie Randolph, an amazing team in the late 70s. I was 7, 8 years old when they won those World Series. But I just remember going to a game and looking at my mom and going, I was in Yankee Stadium. I looked at my mom and I went, this stadium is loaded with assholes. I was 8 years old. I was 8. And I just made a really grown-up decision where I said, I can't do this. If my team winning means that all these assholes are going to be happy, then I'm out. I can't root for this. So so I became a fan, like an independent fan. Like I liked players. And then when I moved to Seattle to start doing stand-up in 1993, 3 of my Yankees that I grew up watching were with the Seattle Mariners. Lou Piniella was the head coach. Willie Randolph was a base coach. And right. Goose Gossage, I believe, was the relief pitcher from
Who
the Yankees.
Who doesn't like Goose Gossage?
Yeah, and I became a fan.
And he hates the Yankees now.
Of the Mariners. Is that right?
Oh,
wow. So I became a Mariners fan because it was easy to do. It's like, okay, well, I got a couple Yankees here that are carrying me over. And I hadn't seen professional baseball since I was a kid because I moved to Arizona when I was 10. And there was no baseball except for spring training. But the spring training, we didn't get the Yankees spring training in Arizona. We got Cubs. We had Cleveland in Tucson, the Indians, which was made famous in the movie Major League. It
right.
opens with spring training in Tucson at High Corbett Field. But
it's also the only time the Indians would win it.
Yeah, exactly. But I don't even know. Like, I just jumped in and started talking. What is usually the theme with this podcast? Like, where does it go? Because I just spent 15
exactly
minutes.
Exactly what you just did.
Yeah.
It's just
filibustering.
Drink. Well, we didn't do the drinks or the jokes, but.
Well, I think we could wrap up and we'll
start.
No,
we're not wrapping up. It's too early. We're only 25 minutes in here.
I'm
Craig is on a roll. I am not rapping.
You got a 4-minute story?
Do I have a 4-minute story?
What is I maybe I'm being an idiot, but what? Oh, I got you. But we could do. What's the problem with Gene Simmons?
The Gene Simmons story.
Because I remember seeing you on Stern when he was on, and you were doing him.
Yeah.
And you were selling everything.
Yeah.
And he was so mad.
It was crazy.
This is the Gene Simmons douche.
Well, it's crazy because when
he
I was
said the Gene Simmons
Oh my God, it was crazy. What happened is I spent a year sitting next to Howard Stern, where I would chime in as different celebrities saying awful shit, and I was doing all these abstract characters. I've always been able to do any voice that I hear because of how I grew up.
I think your story of growing up is one of the greatest.
I wanted to segue into that because his whole family is deaf.
Everyone in my family.
Oh, get out of here, really?
My mom, my dad, and my sister are all completely deaf. My mom was born completely deaf from a birth defect. My dad was born with all of his hearing. Lost it when he was a kid. Got into an accident. Popped out his eardrums. So he had to go to deaf schools where he met my mom. And they had my sister first, who was born with my mom's genes, completely deaf. And then I was born with my dad's genes with all my hearing. So growing up in a deaf family, I couldn't learn how to talk from my family. I learned how to talk by copying all the voices I heard on TV. And I was always able to mimic any kind of voice that I hear. And that's how I didn't get an accent from the Bronx, where I'm from. I just learned how to talk by watching TV. There's a little, like, it's like these little nuances that we pick up that lead to whatever our little silly accents are, because we hear everybody around us and we just naturally assimilate. And that's why deaf people have no tone, because they're not listening to anybody like, oh, I'm going to adjust to sound like Mark. It's like you can't hear anything, so your voice is just a raw sound.
Right.
And then, but for us, our ears are working and we listen to how everybody communicates and we just adjust and we pick up whatever little accents come along the way.
I had an interesting question. I've listened to a lot of podcasts talk about this. My stepdad worked in the 90s as an undercover cop in Washington, D.C., where there's a huge deaf population.
Yeah, because of Gallaudet University.
Right.
Deaf university.
So I wanted to ask you, him and his undercover partner went up and arrested someone on a public bus, and they're like, you're under arrest. And they're like, we didn't do anything. They're like, we speak sign language, asshole. And they were just because they're deaf doesn't mean they're not the bad people. Right. So they were about to like jump someone, and they were signing back and forth, and they caught him. So I wanted to know, you would never be able to tell by looking at you that you speak sign language. Yeah. Have you ever caught someone talking shit?
Oh yeah, well, about me, because I'll try to help out deaf people. I try to help out deaf. Anytime I see deaf people in distress, like trying to communicate, I'll go, oh hey, I'm look at the deaf people and I'll go, hey, I actually know sign language. I can help out. And I'll look at the deaf person and go, hey, I know sign language. They go, oh, thank God. Okay, please tell them. And then they'll start signing like really fast. And I need to spell most of the stuff. Like, I'm not good with a lot of words.
Right.
And my mom never fixed my sign language. She just and by the way, and by the way, a lot of my signs are just flat fucked up and wrong. But my mom knew what I meant.
Saying, right.
And
it's
so,
like a baby with a lisp.
Yes. Yes. Oh my God.
But that's my son.
Right. My mom's friends have come over and I'll try to talk to them and they'll go, what? And then my mom will go, oh, he means this, and she'll do the word. And they'll go,
that's
why
so
didn't
funny.
And they'll go, why didn't you correct it? And she goes, well, it's so cute. Like, he's so stupid. He's such a moron.
So that's the only time you had an accent.
Yeah. He's such a moron.
He signs with an accent.
He thinks when he signs giving myself the shocker, he means he's hungry. Like, yeah. Like, yeah.
So it was your mom's friends that talk shit?
Yeah. So, well, no. What happens is when I ask deaf people to slow down, when I'm trying to help them, I'll go, wait, can you spell? And they'll go, yes. And I'll go, wait, can you spell? I'm sorry. Is it T-R? Wait, I'm sorry. Back up. T-R. Wait, Becca, I'm sorry.
Look at the typewriter. Back up.
R-A. And I'll try to, and then I'll see one person in that group going, this guy's a fucking moron. And I'll go, hey. I know that one. I'm trying to help you here, okay? You know? But yeah, I'll always.
Yeah, but you're like the guy where people go, do you speak Spanish? And you go, sí.
Chimichanga? Chimichanga?
There was one time I was in an independent film. It was a small role in this independent film where I played a deaf guy and who's part of a deaf couple. It was a dream sequence. And I believe the star of the movie was Ally Sheedy. Is that the girl that was in Breakfast Club?
Yes.
Okay. Ally Sheedy was the star of this movie. She has a dream where she's walking through a park and she sees a deaf couple. in love. They're very affectionate, and she notices them and then continues walking. And then all of a sudden, the girl jumps up and says, "No, I don't want it. I don't want the baby. I want an abortion." And then she wakes up, shoots up out of bed. So I'm going to play half of this deaf couple.
Greg played the aborted baby.
Yeah. Man, I got some range. I got range. I can play from 60 to aborted. I'm all the way. So anyway, so I have this girl who's going to be my girlfriend, and I want to teach her some basic sign language because I'm telling her, like, you know, it's kind of offensive to deaf people if you're just moving your hands. So let me teach you some basic signs, like I love you, and, you know, whatever, like little simple things. But I don't know what the sign is for abortion. So that's kind of key to this whole scene. So I email my sister. I email my sister and I go, "Hey, I'm going to do this movie and I need to know what the sign is for abortion. I'm going to teach this girl some sign language." And my sister writes back and describes the sign. She describes it, but I don't understand in her description. I'm like, "Wait, what?" Like, and then I'm like, "Fuck." I walk out into Times Square. There's a pack of deaf people in Times Square right there. And I go, "Oh, shit." And I walk over and I walk right I walk right in the middle of this group of deaf people and I go, hi, I need some help. Can you help me? I need to know what is the sign for ABORTION. And they're looking at me and they're like, what? And I go, I need to know the sign for ABORTION. And they're looking at me and they go, oh, it's this. And it's very rough. It's just a grab your stomach and like a throwaway like that. Because sign language is very blunt.
Direct.
It's very blunt, very direct.
To the point.
So I go, okay, so this right here, this is ABORTION. And they said, yes. And I said, oh, thank you. And I walked away and they're like, that guy's going to tell his deaf girlfriend to get an abortion. What kind of sick fuck is that? Oh! Everybody in this writing class
so
just
weird.
Turned around. Abortion!
He's imitating deaf people talking, and everyone's like, what the fuck is he yelling for? Go.
We're doing a workshop about abortion! Everybody in the next room is trying to...
That was jokes and storytelling.
Thank you, Craig Gass.
Thank you.
Last call.
Thanks for listening to Drinks, Jokes, and Storytelling.